Ohio football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown, and he throws an awesome block so his teammate can score instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you another chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scorer scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. Everyone knows the most exciting part of football is the score. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you have a chance to keep the fun going even after the first player crosses the goal line. Plus, you can enjoy second chance all season long. Place a first TD scorer wager today. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Let me become your major project. I'm talking about a book, not a magazine article. Follow me and my work day by day in as much detail as you can stand. And your book will end with me transporting myself 15 feet through space from one telepod to another. That's what's really missing.
Hello and welcome once again to The Cinephiles, where each week we enter the world of a great film, we explore its themes, the history, the filmmaking, and the influence it has on us today. And John, we have been doing this, as of this moment, for 400 episodes of The Cinephiles. This is our 400th episode.
Hold on. 400th, you say? I think this is right. No? Yes. 400 episodes. You can't see it, but we're doing John Cusack say anything kind of bows to ourselves in the middle of the street.
You chose the John Cusack bow. You didn't show. There are a whole bunch of one you can choose from, but that is an excellent one.
That is the excellent. Right? Isn't that a great bow? It's just to himself and Ione Sky and John Mahoney watching him from the... Yeah, I mean, this is amazing. 400 episodes, and arguably we've never been better, which I really am proud of that over the last few weeks. Obviously, I'm proud of every episode we do. I am actually legitimately proud of every episode we do, but certainly the last few episodes with through our Paul Newman, Robert Redford thing, we couldn't have come through a better stable of movies and really shown what the show was all about more firmly than we have over the last few episodes. Heading into this one, and I'm excited that 400th episode is one of my favorite movies from when I was a teenager, and that we're going to dive into it for Halloween. I'm so excited to talk about this movie because we rarely do horror on the Cinephiles, but every Halloween we do pick one to have some fun with, and this is one that I just cannot wait for us to talk about. But 400 episodes, brother, it's been fun, and it's been educational, and it's been a hell of a ride for sure.
It's crazy, and I think it's like 8+ years, 400 episodes. There are a whole bunch of fantastic TV shows, some of the greatest shows of all time, that did not last 8 years and did not have 400 episodes. And we, 400 episodes is a lot.
Yeah.
That is, and particularly since that means like we're probably at around 800 hours or so of material that we've put out. And I feel the same way you do. I've been really proud of every episode. And I feel like this last run of episodes this year, 2024, has been a great year for the Cinephiles.
100%. I think our advisory board has been a nice new addition to our overall approach to the show as well. Their input, their analysis, their fun conversations, their suggestions for stuff has been another reason why the show has kind of evolved into something else entirely, and a new way to approach the show and a new way to appreciate the show as well.
Totally agree. And for those of you who are enjoying the show, the best way to support us is by going to patreon.com/thecinephiles or to Apple Podcasts, where you can subscribe in both places and get ad-free versions of the show, as well as access to our Cinephile shorts. And if you on patreon.com/thecinephiles, you can join, as John just mentioned, our advisory board, which is a huge help in charting the future of the Cinephiles.
Yeah, and another way that you can help us out on the Cinephiles, if you can't be part of the Patreon, when we do our ads, you hear the clients that support us, the many great sponsors that we have here on the show. We would encourage you, if you hear of any product during those ad breaks that you like and you want to try out, please use our code, because that lets people know and lets those sponsors know that you're a big fan of the Cinephiles and that you're a big fan of their product and that you're using our code, which encourages them to keep sponsoring us as we go along here on the show. We've had some really great sponsors over the last year as well that have, like Fiji Water and Roundhouse Provisions, and so many fantastic sponsors that have come aboard that we're real proud to have as sponsors of our show.
And as you mentioned, today we're into our Halloween film. We are doing The Fly.
Yeah!
And this is not only a fantastic horror film from the mid-80s, but this is also the first time we've tackled a David Cronenberg film on The Cinephiles. So, John, I will ask you first, do you know how you first came to David Cronenberg?
Oh, that's a good question. I think I was aware of David Cronenberg at a young age because, like, there were films I couldn't see. Like, I wasn't allowed to see, like, Videodrome. Remember Videodrome?
Oh, yeah.
That was one that my parents would not let me go see.
Your parents were right.
Oh, yeah. That was a very rough movie. And so I was aware of that. But I'll tell you the first exposure I had to David Cronenberg, and that was The Dead Zone. The Dead Zone was it was either on TV, back in the old days, they didn't have it on circulation all the time, these films. But when a film finally was out for, like, I think 2 years, it would come on syndication or it would come on a station. You could watch it. And I remember watching Dead Zone and I was just like, what is this? This is awesome. I loved Christopher Walken. I still occasionally shake people's hand and do the Christopher Walken from that movie just to mess with them a little bit, like, and tell their future. So it's fun to do that because of that movie. But I just remember that movie putting the hook in me, but good. And that's what got me into Stephen King. Seeing David Cronenberg's The Dead Zone, finding out that Stephen King wrote that book is what got me into Stephen King books. And I started reading those religiously as a teenager, renting them from the library, reading those dog-eared paperbacks of all the different ones he had had out at the time, got into Richard Bachman stuff because of that. So David Cronenberg is kind of an interesting director, or an important director rather, in my formative years as a teenager. And then we get into The Fly, which really rocked my world when I watched it as a teenager in high school. You know?
So for me, my first experience, I think, was seeing the commercial for Scanners.
Oh, yes,
Scanners. And be just scared shitless watching the trailer and going, because I don't go to scary movies. I don't like scary movies. And then, but it was also the thing where at that era, mid-80s, end of high school, beginning of college, this is the thing I just don't think exists anymore, which is when you went over to friend's house and there was like six of you, there was always a movie. We always rented VHS tapes and there were movies playing. And so, like, Dead Zone was a movie I first saw in the background at someone's house. And it was one of those, I walked by like six times and then I went, I'm really scared, but I'm scared to not, you know, when you're at the, I'm scared to not watch what happens.
Right.
Like, you don't want to, because then it's, if you don't get to the end of the scary thing, then you just have the scary thing living in your cowardly little brain like mine. So I finally just sat down and watched, you know, the second half of Dead Zone. And then, of course, The Fly. And then, man, I remember when Dead Ringers came out.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And Dead Ringers just, we went all but to see it in the theater. And it's just that weird mix of Cronenberg kind of body horror, uncomfortable stuff. And then I just have to briefly tell you my Videodrome story, which is that I didn't see it until after film school when I was doing the DVD job. Mm-hmm. And so we got assigned that DVD. So I watched Videodrome over and over and over again for like a month. And it was exactly at the same time I was reading Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance for the first time. And that deals with like sanity and what is reality and what is not reality. And so I'm like listening to that book and then driving in and watching Videodrome on repeat all day. And I feel like I went as close to actually going crazy at that time because of fucking Videodrome. It just stuck in my head in Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. That's awesome. And I was like, wait, what is real? Is anything real? Is this world real? What's happening? Yeah, really messed me up.
Wow. And I still have not seen Videodrome, dude. And I still have not seen Scanners. So I've only just seen clips from those movies, but never the whole thing. So I got to catch up on those for sure.
He's a fascinating filmmaker who has just continued to make these are the movies I make. And really interesting ones later on, like Eastern Promises and History of Violence. History like those Violence. Are fascinating films.
Yeah. Not to mention being an actor consistently throughout his career as well. So yeah. Interesting cat, that Cronenberg.
Totally. And do you remember how you first came to The Fly?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I saw this trailer and I was a huge Goldblum fan. So from Buckaroo Banzai and other films, like I liked him. I think I thought Gina Davis was beautiful. I don't remember if Tootsie put the hook in me for Gina, But I know seeing her in this, the way they presented this, you're at that age as a, 15, 16 year old where it's like, oh man, this is scary shit. But so you want to go see it. So yeah, I got into the theater to see that one. Cause you know, it was a small town of Virginia. They didn't really moderate the 17 or under type of thing. So, or 17 or over type of thing. So I got in to see the movie and I just remember being absolutely insane for this film. When I saw it, loved it, went multiple times to see it in the theater, and then ended up copying off of TV, you know, when you could record on VHS, because we couldn't, at the time, we couldn't afford 115. It was like every once in a while I could buy a VHS movie, but it wasn't consistent enough as much as I wanted them. And then I would watch that tape over and over and over again. This is a film that absolutely put the hook in me in so many ways for Jeff Goldblum, but also what the commentary of the film is, what the commentary of the film is making. There are some great quotable lines, and this is a very sympathetic protagonist who goes bad, but then redeems himself by the end. So it's such a fascinating film about what you can experience in a situation like this beyond just the body horror. There's more going on here. And throughout my life, I've come back to the film numerous times because of certain things that are going on, which we'll get into as we talk about the movie. But yeah, I remember being a 16-year-old kid, probably going to see it with a bunch of friends in Dale City and enjoying the movie.
So I definitely did not see it in the movie theater. Mm. And I had one of those moments where, you know, I'm with friends probably in college and someone said to me, wait, you've never seen The Fly? And then it was just, we're going to the video store. We're renting this right now. And watched it. And I saw it a bunch. I know I've said this many times. It's just what my movie watching habits were as opposed to what they are. I saw it a bunch in the late 80s and early 90s. Mm. And I hadn't seen it for 20 years, you know, when I sat down to do this research. And it's so funny. I know I kind of said this when we talked about The Verdict. There were a whole bunch of stuff that I absolutely 100% remembered. And then there's a bunch of stuff that I really didn't remember. And part of it is that it's just the world has changed so much that there are certain things that pop out today that didn't pop out to me as strongly, you know, 30 years ago when I first saw it.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I've had to battle throughout my entire career, because I said a couple of comments and I've talked about this before, but I just want to reiterate it, is I do like horror. A lot of people hang this Roka hates horror thing on me, and it's not true. I like certain types of horror, and I like to be scared. I don't like the cheesy slasher type horror. I'm not into Friday the 13th Part 10 or anything. That's not my jam. But stuff that's intellectual horror, stuff that's horror that's like goes into the body horror type of stuff, those are the things that I'm into. Like one of my favorite cheesy horror films that I loved was S, that one where he turns Dirk Benedict into a snake, from a human into a snake. That's an insane movie. That's an insane. Strother Martin is the doctor. It's an insane movie with a damn good cast. But I love that stuff, you know, because growing up in the 70s, Steve, I'm sure you remember this. They had those horror films on repeat on those local channels all the time. So you were able to see so many of those cheesy 70s horror films that are now kitsch or cult classics now. And enjoy them. And so I was into horror. It's just that I felt some of the horror a few years ago wasn't as strong. But over the last few years, we've seen an explosion of really good horror films and different approaches to horror that I think are fantastic to experience. And I definitely think this is still a classic horror film for what it does and still holds up today, having watched it again for our podcast.
So I think this is what I'm just coming into my brain right now, that there's sort of a sliding scale, which is when it comes to genre, because like there are people that love horror the way that I loved martial arts movies as a young guy, which is I was going to see all of them.
Yeah.
And I was there to see the fight scenes. And if the movie happened to be good, that was a great bonus. But if the movie was stupid, but I got three great fight scenes, I was kind of happy too. And there are a lot of people, I think, that are like, if it gives me the things that I want from a horror film, the scares, the gore, whatever it is, that then they're in all the way. And then other people who are less into that genre go like, well, I want to go see a good movie. So my feeling is like there are all sorts of horror movies and thrillers that I love because they're great movies. But in terms of just going to see a horror film the way that I went to see a kung fu film as a younger person, that's not my thing. I am not going to just show up to go, oh, it's another horror movie, I got to catch it, whatever it is. That's not how I feel at all.
Yeah. I think I'm in that boat as well.
Yeah. Should we do a little bit of pre-production?
Yeah. Let's hear about it.
So obviously this starts with the 1958 movie, which is based on a short story by George Langelon. So, you know, we've talked about sometimes that maybe we might have in the past as more insecure younger people exaggerated which movies we had seen and which movies we hadn't and claimed to see movies that maybe we hadn't seen. I think both of us have admitted to that sin in the past. Well, here's one I would like to add to it.
Okay.
I was certain I had seen this movie.
The original. Yeah, yeah.
I never had because I just rewatched it. It was so clear in my brain. Part of it is because I'd seen clips from it, I guess. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so I had images in my head and I just assumed because I could remember going to see The Mummy and watching Frankenstein and just going through all the, you know, monster movies at a certain era. And so I just was like, if someone said, did you see the original Vincent Price in, Fly? I was like, yeah, of course I have. Written by James Clavell. I knew that. Of course I've seen it. And I watched it last night and I was going, I have never seen this movie ever. It's totally bizarre.
Did that ending still work for you? That painful, that heartbreaking ending? Did it?
I don't think the whole movie doesn't work for me.
I know the movie's not that strong, but the ending is great.
No, that moment is great.
Yeah, yeah.
But like the movie is so bizarre.
Yeah, it's just cheesy.
It's super cheap. I don't know what the hell Vincent Price is doing in it.
Get a paycheck.
And someone comes up with the idea of remaking it, and they hire Charles Edward Pogue to write the screenplay. He is famous for such films as Psycho 3 and Dragonheart.
Oh.
Writes a screenplay. They bring it to Stuart Kornfeld, who's an executive. He likes it. He brings it over to Fox, and Fox owns the rights to the original 1958 film. So you have to make a deal with them. And they're not feeling that good about it. And so finally they make a deal with him. It's like, well, look, Fox will distribute this film, but you have to raise the money separately. If you can raise the money to make the film, we will distribute it.
Yeah.
So he goes to someone he had worked with in the past. And this is this thing I didn't know about until I read his autobiography, which is he goes to the king of horror films, Mel Brooks.
Mel Brooks.
And this is what's so cool. And his I know I mentioned on the show before, his autobiography is just fantastic. It's everything you want from Mel Brooks' autobiography. And he is so much cooler than I thought he was. And one of these things is that it started with, I think, The Elephant Man and Francis, which he wanted to produce these films, but he knew if he said a Mel Brooks production that people would think it was a comedy, and he didn't want to overshadow the movie. So he created Brooks Films, and he made sure that his name was never around any of these.
Wow.
Yeah.
What a smart man. What an incredibly smart man, you know?
And generous too. Like, yes. He's like, it's okay. I want to make this movie. And he, you know, and so they bring him the script because Stuart Kornfeld had produced Elephant Man with him and he gets 10 pages in and just hates it. And they go, Mel, read a little bit further, read a little bit more in the script. And the big thing is if you watch the 1958 original, it's the structure of it's totally bizarre. But like the big thing is that basically goes through the transporter with the fly and they switch one hand and their heads. So there's a human with a fly head and a fly hand and a fly with a human head and a human hand. But the fly can't, once that happens, he can't talk because he's got a fly head and it happens instantly. And the big thing that they came up with in this first draft is it should happen gradually. That's really, and that just that idea alone is the genius of this movie. I think.
Agreed. 100% agreed.
But still not happy with the script. And so they go, well, we want to get it. We know who the perfect person to direct this is David Cronenberg. They were both fans of Scanners and Dead Zone and like, this is who we want. And this is where this is crazy because we found so many linkages. Like we had linkages between Redford and The Verdict and all these weird things. We've been all these little stories that overlap. Well, we have another one that overlaps because David Cronenberg has to say no because he's working on another movie at this time. And that movie is Total Recall with Dino De Laurentiis.
What an interesting.
Isn't that crazy?
That is crazy.
And if you want to hear of the saga of what Cronenberg was doing on Total Recall and how he ended up leaving, I would listen to our episodes on Total Recall. It's a fantastic conversation with Brendan McDonald. So he can't do it. Yeah. So they bring in a new writer, which is Wallen Green. He'd wrote The Wild Bunch. He'd wrote Sorcerer, The Brinks Job, RoboCop 2, and later on goes to TV where he writes a bunch of Hill Street Blues, Law and Orders, NYPD Blue, ER. So really good writer. Nobody liked this version of the script. So then they see a short film from a director named Robert Bierman, who they bring in. I think he's a British director.
Okay.
They're getting right towards the shoot. They have a script. They're supposed to go into production like within weeks. And this is just so crazy and so tragic, is right before they're supposed to start shooting, they find out, he finds out that his daughter was killed in a tragic accident in South Africa.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Wow. And so they shut everything down and Mel goes, look, you got to go take care of your family.
Yeah.
You know, do what you got to do and, you know, take a month. So they shut the whole production down for a month. He goes off to be with his family. After a month, comes back. He's supposed to start shooting. He goes, I'm not ready to shoot. And Mel goes, this is all Mel Brooks. He says, mm-hmm. take 3 more months. And if you're not, and you have to understand, if you're not ready to shoot, then we've got money invested. We got our production ready. He's like, we have to move on, but take 3 months. He takes 3 more months. He says, I can't shoot this movie. And Mel says, okay. And they have him under contract. He's in breach of contract.
Yeah.
And they could sue him. They could take, you know, they could do all this stuff. Sure, and they could just go, no, this is, we part ways. You had a horrible tragedy in your life. We're going to move on.
Right.
Which, because Mel Brooks is a really good guy. That's from everything I've seen.
Seems like, dude.
Yeah. The problem is now they're in trouble with Fox because they've made all these deals and now they're over budget. They're way behind on schedule and they need to bring another director in. Well, guess what? Total Recall has now fallen completely apart and Cronenberg is available. He says, okay, I'll do it, but I need more money than this other guy. This other guy, Robert Bierman, hadn't done features that were successful. Cronenberg's a bigger director. So they have to find more money for it. And then he says, and I get to rewrite the script however I want. And they say, tell you what, you can rewrite it however you want. And if we don't like it, we are going to throw it out. And they go, okay. He goes to rewrite the script. And of course they do like it.
Yeah.
And the big thing is where he really felt it needed work was the characters and the relationship.
It's and important.
That's the whole thing. That's the interesting thing watching this movie for me was I was like, the heart of this movie is a love story. This is really a love story.
Yes.
That's the key.
Yes. A tragic love story.
Tragic love story.
That's cut early before it can really flourish. It's cut in the bud, it's just before it can bloom. It's cut from its stem and sadly passes, you know, yeah.
Let me tell you about some of the casting they were thinking about.
Yeah.
The casting director is Deirdre Bowen and Mel Brooks, his number one choice to play Seth was Pierce Brosnan.
Interesting. 1980s Pierce Brosnan. I could see that, actually.
It's like peak Remington Steele right now.
Yeah, I could see that.
Cronenberg says, absolutely not. The next person they go to, and this is would also be perfect, is John Malkovich.
Oh, my God. Wow. In the early 1980s. Yeah. That's interesting. Okay.
Yeah. John Lithgow turned it down. Michael Keaton and Richard Dreyfuss were both considered for the role.
Dreyfuss is considered for everything, for fuck's
sake. This era, totally. Totally.
I can do that. I can become a fly.
But Jeff Goldblum is Cronenberg's idea. And I liked, by the way, that as they're doing the casting process, they know one of the big things is going to be makeup. And so he actually goes to the makeup artist and says, well, what kind of head, what kind of body would you like to do this? And they say, well, not too tall.
Yeah.
Small, flat ears. And no nose and a flat nose. And he goes, well, how about Jeff Goldblum, which is all the opposite of those things.
That's awesome.
He goes to the studio. It's Barry Diller at Fox. And they say, okay, we want to go with Jeff Goldblum. And Barry Diller says, I think that is a horrible mistake, but it is your mistake to make. Mm. And lets them do it.
They probably thought he wasn't bankable, right? Because Goldblum wasn't quite. Yeah. I mean, he's part of the ensemble for Big Show, but he wasn't, you know, the star of the film. So, yeah.
Can you imagine? I just listened recently on the Geek Buddies talking about toxic fandom and all that stuff. Can you imagine a studio today saying to a director, I think that choice is a horrible mistake, but it's your mistake to make?
Yeah, it's a rarity.
By the way, Cronenberg is super loyal as a director, always works with us. He's worked with the same people for decades, almost always shoots in Toronto with the crew that they all know each other. They all work together and they've done it for movie after movie after movie, which I always love hearing.
Yeah. Hey, Steve, I'm coming to you with an issue. I am going to France next year, and I have to say, I'm a little nervous about being able to kind of navigate the country because I don't know French, and I studied it like years and years ago in college, but none of it is taken. So what do you got for me?
Well, I think I got Rosetta Stone, which is the most trusted language learning program available on a desktop or as an app that truly immerses you in the language you want to learn. Rosetta Stone has 30 years of experience with millions of users and 25 languages, including, of course, French. There's no English translations, so you really learn to speak, listen, and think in that language.
Wow, that sounds really flexible. It seems like I could get on this anytime, anywhere. If they've got a mobile app or I can use it on my desktop that fits my schedule. And from what I understand, there's a lifetime membership that gets you all 25 languages for any and all trips and languages I might need in life. And maybe if things are good for me in my life, I'll be able to use all of these languages.
So don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. Cinephiles listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Just visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off, unlimited access to 25 courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today today. You know, John, the summer has been really, really hot. And yeah. My solution to it is to keep Fiji water on hand to keep my family and me hydrated and refreshed. It really is from the islands of Fiji. Drop by drop, Fiji water collects in a sustainable, ancient artisan aquifer 1,600 miles away from the nearest continent, protected and preserved naturally from external elements.
Yeah, Stephen, doing research for Fiji Water because I've really enjoyed the product and I like to find out more about the product. One of the things I discovered is as the water filters through volcanic rock, it collects a unique profile of electrolytes and minerals, resulting in more than double the electrolytes as the other top two premium bottled water brands, giving Fiji Water its soft, smooth taste. Unlike some other premium bottled waters, Fiji Water's electrolytes are 100% naturally occurring.
And this water even has a perfectly balanced pH of 7.7. Fiji Water really is Earth's finest water. And since 2022, its 330 milliliter and 500 milliliter bottles have been produced in 100% recycled plastic. So you can feel proud of your choice in bottled water. Get stocked up on Fiji Water this summer and visit your local retailer to pick some up today for your next backyard party, beach or pool day, hike, or even your home office, which is where I have it right now. It's not just water, it's Fiji Water.
Ohio football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown, and he throws an awesome block so his teammate can score instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you another chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scorer scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. Everyone knows the most exciting part of football is the score. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you have a chance to keep the fun going even after the first player crosses the goal line. Plus, you can enjoy second chance all season long. Place a first TD scorer wager today. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Would you like to get into the fly?
Yes. Well, yes. Let's get into the fly. Let's talk about stuff as we go along. Let's do it.
Wait, you're saying we should talk about stuff as we go through the movie? You're just totally changing up the Cinephiles after 400 episodes.
You know, sometimes I jump the gun and it's like, and Steve tells me off mic, you know, I had that plan for later on in the movie, but it's good. We'll jump on it. So I'm learning to kind of maybe relax a little bit because, again, this is a film I love. So I have to watch myself and not get too overly excited or too jumping into giving all the information out and just, you know, let's go at the pace the show normally goes. We've been successful for 400 episodes. Why change it now?
We start off, the music is super dramatic. Of course, this is from Howard Shore. I think his score is fantastic through the film. And we get those, I would describe it as sort of almost like video game-ish kind of fonts in the title sequence. Yeah. And then we get that green light with the fly title. And that is from the trailer. Is that the marketing department was making the trailer and Cronenberg saw what they were doing, the title, and was like, damn, that's cooler than anything we were doing for our credits. Can we just use that? And they're like, yeah, sure. So that's how it ends up in here.
In certain films, opening credits are so effective at getting you in the mood and the vibe and the energy of the film you're going to watch, right? Not all films do this, but I think horror films do a really good job of it, the good ones, right? And this one, the way it begins, just that sound, it sounds like flies' legs hitting the ground. You know what I'm saying? This,
yeah.
And it has this weird, eerie feeling to it. And you're seeing these fuzzy things, out of focus things moving behind the credits. So it almost looks like it's a colony of flies that are just standing yeah. there sitting there. So we never see them, but out of focus, it gives you that feeling. It's called The Fly. You know, you're in the theater to see The Fly. And so giving you that energy and that feeling and that vibe of like, oh God, what is this? What is this? Right from the beginning, I think it's such a great thing. And you're right, Steve, watching it again this time, again, I haven't seen it in a while. So watching it again for the movie, for this episode rather, the idea that they're already into this relationship right off the bat, like they've been talking at this party and boom, we're catching them almost maybe 5 minutes into their conversation. And it's fascinating. No introduction, no going back and finding out who this person is. No, we're just going right into it. It's really interesting.
And the way he shoots it, it's very, he doesn't like set up a master. We start, I mean, there is a big wide shot in that top down, but then we go right into these close-ups. It's very intimate, and it's very much like they're the only people in the room, you know?
Yeah.
What am I working on? I'm working on something that'll change the world and human life as we know it.
Change it a lot or just a bit? You'll have to be more specific.
So Gina Davis, how she got cast, well, she was dating Jeff Goldblum at the time.
Yep.
And Jeff said, you should read my girlfriend, Gina Davis. And as you mentioned earlier, she had done Tootsie. She had done some other things. And they bring her in as a kind of a courtesy. Yeah. And she came into the audition and apparently just nailed it. She is the very first person that they read for the part. And Cronenberg goes, well, let's just cast her. And they're like, no. We have to read more people. Like, we have to go out. So they had normal auditions, brought all sorts of people in. Yeah. In the end, she was just the best one. And in particular, because Goldblum is tall, and she is also tall. So that just was one physical consideration that really helped.
Yeah, and it's fascinating when you look at Gina Davis, because she fought hard. A lot of people think that she was just a pretty girl, pretty woman and was, you know, became an actress because she fought hard. I mean, she studied for a long time. She took all kinds of odd jobs. She worked I think she was a cashier at the Lord and Taylor's or whatever there in New York. So, and then she worked her way up to be a model in The Window. And the way she got into Tootsie is Sydney Pollack saw her as a clothes model in The Window and found out she was an actress, asked her to come read, and that's how she got cast in Tootsie. So like she had studied to become an actress, but you gotta pay bills and was working these odd jobs. And I was thinking that to myself as I was seeing her in this film, because it's like, this is where everybody woke up to who Gina Davis was.
Yeah.
She wins an Oscar 3 years later. Thelma and Louise becomes this, you know, this feminist rallying cry with her and Susan Sarandon that is epic and forever changes movies. And so it's so amazing to see the progression of her life in like 10, 12 years from where she was to where she ends up after Thelma and Louise. And then of course, League of Their Own, which is another phenomenal film we've talked about here on the show.
What do you want me to be specific here in this room with half the scientific community of North America eavesdropping?
Because this is some kind of sciency event that we're at.
A fair or something. Yeah.
Event. And he's inviting her back to his lab and, you know, trying to lure her with his fancy cappuccino machine.
Somehow I get the feeling you don't get out much.
You can tell that?
Yeah.
And she walks away, and I love that the camera is kind of following her as she walks away, and he follows her.
Sorry, I have 3 other interviews to do before this party's over.
Yeah, but they're not working on something that'll change the world as we know it.
They say they are.
Yeah, but they're lying. I'm not.
How would you describe Jeff Goldblum as an actor?
I think Jeff Goldblum does not get enough credit for the greatness of his ability. A little bit like Walken. Everybody's got a Goldblum impression. Everybody's got a Walken impression. I once watched a comic do Goldblum and Walken talking to each other without saying anything. And it is one of the funniest bits I ever saw in my life. And so we can default into those places. And I think that can sometimes have you forget how good of an actor these two guys really are. And when you're watching Goldblum in this movie, this Goldblum before he transforms into the fly, Goldblum after he transforms into the fly, are two completely different performances, but they're both equally good. You know, Goldblum is a naturally confident, charismatic guy. He always has been. So when he's playing this nerd type guy, he's not leaning into it. It's just there. It's very natural. It's very organic. When he's surprised when she says, "You look like you're not the kind of guy who gets out." Like, "Oh, really? You can tell that?" And so he's legitimately like surprised at these things and these discoveries, but he's also very clear that he is excited about what he's doing, but not overly excited about what he's doing, because he knows he's not fully finished with it yet, but he is excited to tell someone about it. You don't really sense that he's necessarily attracted to her. It's just the attention of it all. And the fact that he can sense that she's an intelligent person, and so they might have a conversation that actually excites him intellectually. And that's coursing throughout their back and forth. And Gina plays it really well, too, because she's like, she walks away from him. She's out of it. And I think there are two tragic moments in the movie when he runs after her in this opening, because if he had just let her walk away, he might have lived to be 80 years old.
Oh, yeah.
But because he runs after her to convince her to go back to the thing with her, that begins the process. And when he gets in there drunk with the fly. Those are the two tragic moments, decisions rather, that Brundle makes without knowing what the end results are going to be. And we have to buy into this relationship. So I think Cronenberg was really smart. They already have chemistry. They're dating each other. They're professional actors. I don't need to do a lot of background about their characters. Let's just dive into this. The audience is going to go along with it. And sure enough, we do.
Well, and the thing about Goldblum is he's Goldblum. You know what I mean? It's true. The Walken thing is that there is an essence to him that is unique. No one is like that.
Right.
And he brings what's so brilliant about him. And I totally agree that people tend to dismiss him because they could just go, "Oh, you're just all these Goldblum. You're just bringing all those Goldblum quirks."
Yeah.
But he brings this guy as a unique character. This isn't the same. There's a nerdy scientist he plays a few years later in Jurassic Park.
Right.
It's not the same guy as this
Completely
guy.
Different guy.
Totally different guys. And they still have some of those Goldblumisms and they're there.
Yeah.
But and this is the thing, is why casting is so key. This is not an exciting scene. But we are instantly involved in these two characters, you know?
Yeah. And he's not bending over. He's not doing anything. He's very clear about who he is. So it immediately grabs your attention. You know?
And then we're driving in this little car because he has convinced her, and he is immediately carsick, which I think is a great little bit.
Right.
And now we end up in this pretty rundown neighborhood. And I think Gina Davis plays a little bit of the, "What have I gotten into?" You know, here.
You know, this is the 1980s. A woman going to a factory with a guy she just met is super dangerous, right? Yep. And we're, as the audience, we're kind of worried, which again, the guy subconsciously ramps up the feeling of dread or horror that we are going to experience. But it kind of begins this process as we go along. And I also think it's smart to give him motion sickness, right, Steve? Because that makes you feel a little connected to him, and it makes him feel vulnerable to us. And so we don't necessarily see him as a threat just yet. And so we're just watching as this goes along.
Well, and it's going to be in contrast to how physically powerful he is.
Yes.
Later on in the film.
Yes.
We slide open this big door and we go into what we recognize now as like this live work loft space, you know. But what Cronenberg said in the commentary track, which I think is true, is that wasn't a thing in 1986.
Right.
Like this was a weird thing. The idea that you would live and work in the same room. And she comes in, looks around again, like, "What exactly have I gotten into?"
Yeah.
And there's a piano in the middle of the set, and Goldblum goes and sits down and plays the piano because Jeff Goldblum can play the piano. And what I like about what their motivation was, but they're like, "Well, let's give something that Jeff Goldblum loves in the middle of his space to make him feel comfortable." And he and Gina Davis did duets for the cast and crew, for the crew between takes. And that piano was getting played all the time in the course of the shoot. And I'm like, "Well, that's kind of awesome."
Yeah. Plus, I mean, he's not going to play music. So he plays music literally for her, and he's again, he's like a nerdy kind of socially awkward guy. So he's trying to impress her by just jumping onto a piano and playing. Look, I've been the nerdy, socially awkward guy trying to impress girls, and you do the weird awkward thing where you do the thing you do best, and it's kind of, they have no interest in it, and you have to do. But like she's here to get a story, so she's dealing with his quirks to try to get to what it is he wants to show her, and you see that in their interactions here.
And she's immediately going, "Listen, maybe this is a bad idea."
Yeah,
and he steps into that by going,
"Oh, it's too late. You've already seen them. Can't let you leave here alive."
And then we take a look at the pods. So here's how the design came about of these. Initially, they went, we're going to, in the original 58 movie, they're kind of like phone booths, you know, like just these glass kind of cubes. And he said, no, I want something that's different. And he's trying to describe what he wants. And it ends up, Cronenberg is a big motorcycle guy. And he says, I want something that looks sort of like the cylinder heads on my Ducati engine. And so they go, what do we don't know what that looks like. And he rides his motorcycle over to the set design people and says, take a look at this. And they look at it and they basically take apart his Ducati and bring the motor to the stage. And if you look at a Ducati engine, this is basically just flipped upside down versions of the Ducati, you know, cylinder head on his motorcycle.
Wow.
Yeah.
Smart. Yep.
And he kind of is describing what these things are and that he had a prototype and now he has these two. He calls them telepods. And she's being polite at this point.
So what do they do, the phone booths?
Telepods. Okay. I need an object.
The note I wrote down here is everything Jeff Goldblum does is interesting.
Yeah.
Say, do you have something on you that's personal that I could use, something uniquely you, an item of clothing or jewelry?
And she goes, okay. And then, and this is a bold move, she reaches way up her skirt and pulls down her stocking to give to him.
There always has to be, well, not always, but there, a lot of good horror always has this sexual element to it, right? And I think this works here because we as the audience, again, are like, Gina Davis is gorgeous. So we're watching at this time. So when she looks up, now we're like, oh, what is this? What's going on here? And he's clearly, you know, discombobulated a little bit by it. And he's looking at it scientifically, oh, the texture, the feel, the chemicals, the fabric, whatever. But, you know, she's doing that in his reaction to it. And so I agree with you. It's bold and it's sexy and it works for a horror film. And it also kind of works at the beginning of this relationship because she's very strongly doing this, you know?
I think she has all sorts of voices in her head that said she really shouldn't have come back to this guy's place. She really shouldn't be here. And I think there's other voices in her head that's going, I like this guy. You know, I really, there's some about this guy that she's really intrigued by.
Yeah.
And he puts the stocking in one of the telepods. And like in all these things, you want to show the process. So we show the computer process. We show the initiation countdown. We show the way the doors on the pod locks. All that stuff is important.
Yeah.
We're looking at that stocking and there's light spinning on it. And then there's a big flash and it disappears. Mm-hmm. But by the way, the big flash is big old-fashioned flash bulbs. That weren't being made anymore, like these particular, but they're just really big. The old ones where you had to throw them away after you use them once.
Yeah. It reminds me of the DeLorean in Back to the Future when it does the spark and it takes off. It has that totally kind of element to it. Yeah.
That makes sense because I think both, there's no CG in this. This isn't, nothing is computer generated. So when you see those lightning bolts, they're animated. They're hand-drawn animation, which I'm pretty sure the Back to the Future lightning stuff is too. So it makes sense that that looks the same.
Great. The world's largest microwave oven. I'm glad I didn't give you my Rolex, if I had a Rolex.
No, you're missing the point. Look.
And he points to the screen, and on the screen it says, teleportation successful. And we go over to the other pod, and it opens, and there's smoke. And then, as the smoke clears, we see her stocking sitting right there.
Is that a hologram?
And he tells her to pick it up and find out if it's real.
I don't think I get it. What happened?
You get it, all right. You just can't handle it. Your stocking has just been teleported.
And she's now trying to get her head around what's going on here.
This is an important thing. Look, you walk the line with her character, right? Because what she tells us later is that she was a science major in college and that what's-his-face talked her into becoming a journalist for science, for the magazine. She's no dummy. But we as the audience need someone to stand in for us to explain certain things, right? I mean, you and I knew teleportation because of Star Trek, but how many people might not have known teleportation or what it meant to walk and came into this movie and watched it? And so having Gina occasionally play that she's behind the curve on what's happening or not sure or needs it explained, that's the part she's serving. But if you look at it logically, she would have gotten it and understood it and asked more questions about it, what have you. Because I mean, she went there looking for a story. She's a science major. She's smart. She's written for the magazine for a bit. So you, it doesn't make sense that she wouldn't know, but you allow for it because, you want to have it explained to you. So it just kind of floats by you, you know, but you can make a case that she should have known all these things as it was going along, you know?
Well, yeah, but I also go like, if someone brought me into their lab and said, hey, I'm doing teleportation, I'd be like, really? Come on. Because I don't believe that that's easily possible.
Yeah, but you'd know what it was. You'd know what it meant, right?
Yes.
But I think she's serving the... I'm saying, I'm excusing it because she's serving the purpose for the audience, right? Someone has to.
And what she does, now that she's realizing this is for real, she pulls out one of those little cassette recorders and hits record on her cassette.
This is incredible. How could you do this alone?
And I love his explanation. He says,
I don't work alone. There's a lot of stuff in there I don't even understand. I'm really... a systems management man. I farm bits and pieces out to guys who are much more brilliant than I am. I say, build me a laser this, design me a molecular analyzer that, they do, and I just stick them together. But none of them knows what the project really is.
This motherfucker is talking about building a teleportation device like he's building a desk from IKEA. You know, I don't make the steel. I don't make the screws. I don't make the wood. It's in the box. So I put it together. I know what I need. And I ask certain people to send me the pieces.
What I love about the explanation is it basically says, we can't really afford a lot of extra actors and a lot of other stuff to do this. And so this explanation makes it perfectly sane why he's just alone in this, you know, warehouse space doing this thing by himself.
Look, we had to pay Cronenberg $1 million. We can't afford more actors, for God's sakes.
Yeah. And we hear that the company that's financing it, they don't even know what he's trying to build. They just trust him. Wow, this is pretty great.
Because he's cheap.
And then we hear a beep because her tape has run out of space and she has to flip it over.
Yeah.
But he suddenly sees that she's recording and he is not happy.
What's that? What are you doing?
Well, you want me to get the quotes right, don't you?
Quotes? No. I thought this was personal. You can't write about this.
Because he was really just bringing her over to impress her and for like a date, right?
At least that's what he thought.
Don't you dare write a story. I'd never have told any of this stuff to a journalist.
But you did tell this stuff to a journalist.
Well, yeah, in a way, I suppose I did. That
sure did.
Wait a minute.
And now she's heading out. She's got her story. She's going to get out of there. And we go to Monolith Publishing.
Bum, bum, bum. In Toronto.
In Toronto. I was like, wow, Monolith Publishing. Like, this is not very subtle with that name. And she's in her office with her boss, which is Stathis Borens, played by John Getz.
Yeah, John Getz, interesting actor. Still working today, by the way. He'd be unrecognizable from what you remember him in this movie with that beard. But he's been a number of things. He founded the theater company there in Napa County, California. He's one of the founding members of that theater company that's there. He started out in Happy Hooker, which some of you may remember from the 1970s. We're old enough. But then he was in Blood Simple, which is the first Coen Brothers movie, Born on the 4th of July, Curly Sue. He was in Finch's Zodiac movie. He was in The Social Network. He was Cy in the lawyer and through the whole thing. That's him. Same guy. And he was recently in The Last of Us, that series based on the video game with Pedro Pascal. He was seen in Doom Patrol, and he's got a big, strong recurring role in Bosch as well, which is a show that I watch. So John Getz, still a very in-demand actor, is working all the time, has worked for decades through movies and television shows. And so when I was doing research for him, I completely did not know it was the same guy, I'm telling you. So when I saw that, I was just so happy to see that because he's such a great villain in this movie, who ends up actually doing the heroic thing at the end. You know?
His character is a real weird one to get your head around, I think, today. Cronenberg was interested in him because he loved him in Blood Simple.
Mm-hmm.
And so he comes in for, you'll love this audition story, he comes in for the audition, and he has a terrible headache, like splitting headache.
Ooh.
And so he just, the whole time, he's literally like wincing his way through. His shoulders are up. His body is tense. He's like wincing his way through the whole audition. And then he gets a callback. And he comes into the callback and he starts to do it. And they're like, can you bring back your headache? That's what we liked. And so that headache is what got him the job, is that stress level.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's a joke.
What?
He's conning you. What's an old nightclub routine? The two cabinets.
Listen, that was no nightclub routine. I was there. I saw it.
And by the way, this guy's name Stathis Borans. It's a tribute to Lou Stathis, who was the editor of Heavy Metal magazine, because he often praised Cronenberg's films. So it was his way of like saying thank you for being so positive about my movies early in my career.
You must have made an impression.
What do you mean?
Your magician has followed you here.
And so there is Seth Brundle.
He wasn't impressed by your tape?
He thinks you're a con man.
And I love that Seth is relieved.
I've come here to say one magic word to you.
And he does a gesture with his hands and says,
cheeseburger.
And this is the charm of Jeff Goldblum in this character, you know?
Yeah, they have to make us like him, right? Yeah. They have to make us like him because of what they're going to put him through. And so that we stay connected to him and following his story and feeling terrible for him as he experiences all the things that he's experienced, because she's going to feel that way. So if we feel that way, we can believe that she feels that way, you know? It's so smart.
And I love that we cut to a perfectly generic nondescript version of a fast food restaurant.
Oh, totally.
If this gets out now, Veronica, it'll kill me. The Bartok people will kill me. My colleagues will kill me. She's not ready yet.
One of the things that Cronenberg says as Seth is explaining this is he said it was really important to him that the character of Seth was very articulate, because he had to talk us through what was happening to him. Like, that's what he felt was missing from the 1958 version, is the emotional experience. And so Seth had to be articulate, otherwise he can't talk about this later on in the film.
Let me become your major project. I'm talking about a book, not a magazine article. Follow me and my work day by day in as much detail as you can stand. And your book will end with me transporting myself 15 feet through space from one telepod to another. That's what's really missing.
He appeals to her journalistic instincts, which is like, you could write an article, but if you write a book, you can make a lot more money. You could really make a name for yourself, and we can do this together. So he smartly doesn't, because when he initially, he wants to grab the tape, he wants to take her tape recorder, like that's a violation type of thing, right? What he's now appealing to her is the potential of what it could be in her journalistic instincts. And so it's a smart approach to look at the bigger picture and have her buy into it. You know?
And I think it plays into the connection between these two characters. Mm. And it also shows care. Like, I actually, no, I want you to get something out of this.
Yeah.
She's back at her apartment, which is as contrasting to his, you know, messy loft as you could possibly imagine.
Yeah.
And she hears a noise and starts walking through the dark hallway in her apartment. And this is this weird thing of, because you know you're in a horror movie, everything is a little scary, you know?
Right.
As she's walking through, we hear the sound of a shower, and she opens up the curtain, and there is Stathis, her boss, in her shower.
What are you doing in my apartment?
Just happened to be in the neighborhood. Felt a bit scummy.
I love that Ronnie flushes the toilet on her way out. That's to scalding.
For those of you who know, who've ever lived in apartments like that, it is the worst.
By the way, that was a Gina Davis improv.
Oh, really?
Oh, that was her idea.
I also think this is a way of Cronenberg. I mean, this is such a brilliant script, a deceptively brilliant script. The true horror in this film is Stathis, right? He's the guy that is the true horror in the film, not Brendel, not the fly. Although there are moments where it's certainly terrifying, and he says, if you don't leave, I'll kill you. But because he's trying to take care of her, he's telling her, please leave, because if you don't leave, I won't be able to stop myself. When he saves her, when he stops the abortion, it's because he wants some element of himself to stay alive. And look, you can argue that that's selfish or whatever, but in his instincts, it is to preserve some semblance of humanity that he's lost. But Stathis is the guy that's constantly violating her privacy, violating her life, using the key after they've broken up to go in her apartment to take a shower because he felt scummy. He's the one sitting all night outside the factory while she sleeps with Seth all night. He's the guy that confronts her in a public place, jumps to his knees in mocking her. So he's the real terror in the movie, right? It's the body horror happens to Seth, but he is the actual villain in a way in the movie, which is why, again, by the end,
but also the hero.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's shocking.
That's what's so weird,
that he does the hero move, you know.
Well, this is what, and it's funny. Clearly, this was written to be uncomfortable in 1986. You know, this scene is like, dude shows up. He's, because we hear later that he still has a key and that she hasn't changed the locks.
That's because unconsciously you still want me to come back. Move in again.
It is intentionally made to look like, make him look like a jerk. I mean, going in to your ex's apartment with your key and getting naked and getting in the shower and waiting for them to come home. That's messed up. It was messed up in 1986, but looking at it today really, really messed up.
Yeah. Cause just cause he has a key doesn't mean he's allowed in the house. There's a sovereignty aspect to it all. Right. And so, and he's doing this on purpose. And look, remember, if you watch the movie, he doesn't turn on the shower until she comes through the door. So I just wonder if he was waiting.
He's waiting. And, totally.
In some sick way, sitting there naked in the bathroom, waiting for her to show up. And once she shows up, he's going to jump in. And he probably thinks that she's going to join him because she can't resist him, right? And yet she does.
But one of the things, one of the other reasons he's come is he found out some more information.
He was the leader of the F32 team. Remember that? An inch away from the Nobel Prize for Physics. He was only 20 at the time.
So this is clearly a brilliant guy.
Yeah.
And she just wants to get rid of him.
Are you getting out or am I?
I'll go. I have to put this issue to bed. You want me to come back later and tuck you in?
Yeah, exactly.
And then she asks for her key back and he refuses. I was like, what a creep.
Yeah. And this is what women have been trying to tell us for decades. And we only just finally listened after Me Too. But yeah, this is what they've been trying to tell. And I think it's, you know, if this came out nowadays, I wonder how many YouTube channels would go crazy about, oh, look how they turn the guy who just cares about her into the villain, you know, crying about it. When this is actually what a lot of men unfortunately do, you know. So
we're back with the computer screen and we, where it says something about carbon-based organic life form, and she's there with a video camera, and we initiate the sequence, and then we see a baboon in one of the telepods.
Yeah.
And the camera pushes in on him. And as the camera pushes in, we see the light moving across it. And the baboon disappears in that lightning flash. And this is a motion control shot because you have to have the camera move in at the exact same pace with multiple passes, one with an empty pod, one with a baboon in the pod. Yeah. This is the first motion control shot David Cronenberg ever did.
Oh, wow.
I was very excited about it. The problem was, so baboons are fucking strong.
Yes.
Let's start with that. Are not that trainable, you know? Mm-hmm. Baboon's going to do what a baboon wants to do.
Yeah.
That baboon that was in there did not like those flash bulbs. Because when it got hit with a flash, it sounds like it went crazy, ripped the door off of the telepod.
Jesus.
And these baboons, they have big ass teeth. And yeah. You know, and the trainer had to run in and settle the animal down.
Yeah.
And so when they did take two, the trainer had to be in the pod with him, keeping him calm.
Yeah.
As that, but when those flashes went off.
Apparently only him and Goldblum could control the baboon because Goldblum was so tall, it intimidated the baboon. Yep. It's pretty scary situation.
They're watching the other pod, which we see smoke, and then we see, and we know it's going to go bad.
Yeah.
Like, you know it is. You heard what he said about organic material. When that bloody paw hits the glass, they open the door, the smoke clears, and there is a screaming pile of dying meat. It's later. She's got the video camera on him. She zooms in on him, gets it in focus.
We've got to do this, Seth. Talk to the tape. Get in the habit. The world will want to know what you're thinking.
Fuck is what I'm thinking.
Good. The world will want to know that.
And this is sort of the next piece of, it's important for Seth to document what is happening to him.
Yeah.
Because that's going to be a big part of the movie.
It's two people of science. It makes sense, right? And Goldblum plays this moment of utter dejection so well. You know, he doesn't want to talk about it, but he knows that this is the deal he made with her. But he feels embarrassed as a scientist that he still can't get it right and that he's killed a living creature in this. Because we don't see how they dispose of it. I imagine they shoot it or beat it with a rock or in some way, which we're not exposed to. But it's a horrible thing that he has to. And then you have to clean the fucking telepod. So it's a painful situation that he's experiencing.
Computers are dumb. They only know what you tell them. I must not know enough about the flesh myself. I'm going to have to learn.
Which I think is great. I think it's a great setup. And I also love that he says, I don't want to talk right now, and walks away. It's later on. He's lying down on the sofa bed where she sleeps. She's like in a rocking chair nearby. And she asks,
do you ever change your clothes?
What?
Your clothes. You're always wearing the same clothes.
No, these are clean. I change my clothes every day.
And she opens up the closet and there are a whole bunch of identical suits. And he says,
learned it from Einstein. This way I don't have to expend any thought on what I'm going to wear. I just grab the next set on the rack.
This has stayed with me.
Me too.
Right? For my entire life. And I've been like, if I could be independently wealthy or not care what people think, I would 100% do this. Find a shirt that I really, really like, a pair of pants or workout pants that I really, really like, a pair of shoes that I really, really like, and buy like boatloads of them and never change my clothes and just wear that everywhere I go. I would absolutely do that, you know, because it is exhausting. All right, what did I wear yesterday? What did I wear today? That kind of thing.
Well, yeah. One of the reasons, I've been to Burning Man several times, but that I don't love it the way a lot of our other friends do, is they'll say like, oh, and it's so cool. You get to figure out all these costumes and wear all these fabulous stuff. And I get filled with anxiety just at the thought like, oh, I have to pick out more clothes and more people are going to judge me for my clothes and whether or not they're really as fabulous as everyone else's clothes. I'm like, oh my God, this is terribly stressful. Like my method, as you have probably observed for many years, is I'm currently wearing workout shorts and a t-shirt.
Yeah.
If I work at home, that's all I wear all day.
Yeah.
And I do my wash and I put my t-shirts in a stack and whatever t-shirt is on top, that is the one I wear. Like there's no choosing. And so the idea of like, this is like, oh my God, thank God. Yeah. That would be amazing to just put on the same clothes every single day. That sounds fantastic.
Agreed.
I bought some steaks. Can I make you one?
Well, you can go out.
Cheeseburger.
And then she comes forward and she puts her knee on the bed and you're like, wait, this is moving quickly. She starts to play with his tie, which by the way, a woman starts to play with your tie. That's a sign of something.
You're in there.
You're very cute. You know that?
Am I?
Moves over and starts kissing him. And this, it's so funny. I think this is where you totally get the benefit of the fact that they're actually in a relationship because it seems totally natural that this is happening.
Yep. 100%.
It's later on. Somehow he's rolled onto some piece of equipment that pokes him in the back, and she kisses it to make it feel better.
Sorry. I just want to eat you up, you know? That's why old ladies pinch babies' cheeks. It's the flesh. It just makes you crazy.
And that is the key.
Yeah.
Want to try an experiment?
Sure.
He cuts a piece of steak in two, puts one in the teleportation pod, teleports it, puts both pieces of steak, one teleported, one not, in a pan, and brings it over to her and says,
eat this, I need an objective opinion.
Offers her a bite.
I could use some finesse, but it tastes like a steak.
And then he hands her the other piece, and she's like, no, a dead monkey died in there. I don't want to eat that. But he pushes her to eat it. Gina Davis plays this so well of the reaction to there's something off with the steak.
Yeah.
It tastes funny.
Funny how?
It tastes synthetic.
It's not overt. It's not obvious, but she senses something is off. Yeah.
The computer is giving us its interpretation of a steak. It's translating it for us. It's rethinking it. And something is getting lost in the translation.
You know what I wrote down here? I wrote down two letters, AI.
Yep.
This 100%. Is just where we are right now.
Yeah. Brother, I had the same thought. Everything he's saying is how people say, well, AI can reproduce this, but it can't reproduce it with the human element. And the human element or the physical element, that's the difference, right? And the same thing, exactly what he's talking about. You're so, so right, man. I had the same thought.
Because, and this is the weird thing about trying to get your head around AI is if AI is drawing a picture of a baboon, let's say, it doesn't actually know what a baboon is.
Right.
You know, it's just reproducing what it thinks we want. And so, like, I was listening to someone talking about self-driving cars, and they're saying, like, one of the problems is if you're driving and something falls out of a truck and lands on the freeway in front of you will swerve out of the way.
Right.
And it doesn't matter if it is a piece of wood or a cow or a motorcycle or any other object. Mm. You see an object in front of you swerve out of the way.
Right.
The computer if it learns that a piece of wood falls out of a truck and you should swerve around it, it will do that. But then if a piece of metal falls out of the truck, it won't swerve around it because it hasn't been taught that, because it didn't learn the rule, which is don't run into shit, because the self-driving car doesn't even know it's driving.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or can get hit by things. It's just doing what it's the pattern that it knows how to do, you know?
Our friend of the show, Michael Vogel, has been getting rides home from driverless cars on Uber. And he sends us videos of his ride home on these driverless cars. And I am nothing but horrified at what is happening, but he loves it. And so, because that car is like, we are 5 miles away from your destination. Please make sure you're wearing your seatbelt. Have you checked? Would you like some water? And you're just like, this thing is just driving him home. And yep. I am utterly fucking horrified at being stuck in a car. Like Upgrade, if you guys have seen Upgrade, that's my fear. That situation. I would try it once, but then after that, I would never want to do it again.
So I've read the statistics, and I have not yet ridden in one of those cars. I've read the statistics, and it sounds like for all normal circumstances, that car is safer than a human driver.
Wow.
If everything is, if it never encounters anything weird. But if a kid chases an ostrich into the middle of the road, that car won't know what to do. You know, that's what I mean. It's like it only knows to do what it knows.
Right.
Whereas like, so like you've driven up to my house up the back way, I assume at one point or another, which is the windy road where you frequently have to pull over.
Yes.
To the side and let a car get past you. And then you pull out and cars are constantly backing up and going forward. There's no way a driverless car could make it up that street.
Yeah.
Because yeah, it's yeah. too weird and too like, do I back up or do you going to back up or you're going to back up a little, then I'm going to go to the right, then you're going to do that. That's what that driving is. And AI can't figure that out.
It's so weird.
The flesh. It should make the computer crazy. Like those old ladies pinching babies. But it doesn't, not yet. I haven't taught the computer to be made crazy by the flesh, the poetry, the steak.
I love that line. First of all, I've had some steaks that were pure poetry. And the thing, this was something that was really important to David Cronenberg, is he doesn't like the idea that you have the sciencey people and the arty people and that they're totally different. He was like, no, there's plenty of scientists who have poetry in them. And now he has a new project. He's super excited to like teach the computer the poetry of flesh. The music, one of the things it's doing so well is it's so light and romantic here.
Mm-hmm.
That yeah. it's helping build you your connection between these characters, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And the music is really light as she heads out. She gets in her car. It's very romantic. And then she drives by this Maserati because there is Stathis who has been observing her. And man, he pulls out very aggressively after her.
And this is a 1980s villain thing, right? Like when the collar is up, that's 1980s villain. Like if totally. It's a polo, if it's a jacket, if the collar is up, that is code word for 1980s villain.
And my assumption is that I think Stathis is not getting paid enough as an editor of this magazine to buy that Maserati. I think Stathis comes from money.
Oh, probably. Because he's not used to being told no. That's a great point, Steve. And he totally sat there all night like a child.
And we end up at this store because she's going to buy in some clothing. So maybe he has some other clothes other than his 5 repeated suits that are exactly the same. She's looking at a leather jacket and there is Stathis.
What are you doing here?
I followed you. You stayed with Brundle all night.
So first of all, this is horrible just to begin with.
100%.
Don't you get it? I am finally onto something that's big, huge.
Yeah? What? His cock?
Dude.
Yeah.
And it's public and he's being loud.
Mm-hmm.
And he gets down on his knees and bows to her.
You're a goddess. Thank you for making my most paranoid fantasies come true.
I don't have to report to you, you creep.
In front of everybody. And then, you know, she takes the jacket over and still purchases it. I love that she's, you can be an asshole, but I'm still going to buy this jacket. That's a steal. That's a strength to her that I think is, that moment shouldn't be overlooked. That's a strong moment for her to still buy the jacket for Seth. She is still standing for Seth, standing for her feelings for Seth. She doesn't storm out or run out away from him. She handles her business. And he's making such an utter ass of himself. And how many, I'm sure some of our female listeners and probably some of our male listeners have made asses of themselves or have dealt with guys making asses of themselves in public places in situations like this because they can't handle the fact that someone doesn't want them anymore. You know, and clearly from what she tells us later, he groomed her from the beginning. And once she found her voice and found her strength, she walked away from him because she realized what he was doing, and he doesn't want to let her go. And this is beneath a magazine editor to be doing things like this in public, for God's sake. So it's almost childish. And again, reiterating the fact he is the actual whore. He is the monster. He is the real monster in this movie. Again, even though he gets the heroic moment at the end, he is the monster of the movie.
It's really weird. I don't know I'd be curious. It'll be really interesting to hear other people who maybe haven't seen this movie before, and particularly younger people, like, what do they think of Stathis? Because it's a really problematic character, the way this movie handles it. We're back at the lab. We're back with a baboon in the pod. And once again, we do the same thing. We go through the sequence. It's always important to show the teleportation sequence because we're going to come back to it. That baboon disappears. They open up the door. And the baboon runs out and jumps in Jeff Goldblum's arms.
Yeah. Interesting decision to shoot it from above. I think they were trying to give you a little bit of the horror feeling, like you won't be able to stop this baboon running at Seth, but he jumps into Seth's arms, which calms us down.
By the way, one of the other problems with filming a baboon is that when baboons get excited, they get physically excited. And there were a lot of shots, and I saw a lot of them in the outtakes, of a baboon with a very large erect member
halo
running around on the set. So naturally they couldn't use those takes.
Jesus Christ. That's hilarious.
We pour some champagne to celebrate because they did it. Mm. He's never going to have to get car sick again. I love that as a motivation.
Well, send the baboon out for tests. See if he's really okay.
How long will that take?
Could be weeks.
Really?
Yeah, what?
Well, I was thinking that we could take a holiday.
And I love his performance through this, of the sort of discovery that he's in a relationship.
Just you and me.
There's that little squeak in his voice.
Is this a romance we're having? Is that what it is?
Yeah, could be a romance.
Has Seth Brundle ever had a romance?
I don't think so.
I don't think so either.
And he's experiencing it as a scientist would experience it, right? Like, what does this mean? What is happening? I'm analyzing as it's happening.
Yeah.
But Steve, let me ask you this. Like, she's moving pretty fast.
Yeah.
So is it because she wants him and she's caught up in this new romance? Is this a rebound romance? Like, what is going on here, do you think? And I'm not trying to besmirch the great Ronnie, but I'm throwing it out there. Like, she moves pretty fast in this relationship with him. Is it driven from this connection that she has had with him that she's never had with anyone else? Or is it driven by a rebound type of situation because of the relationship that ended with Stathis, which is still clearly in his mind going on, but not in hers?
I will give you two different answers. The first answer is that for me, I do feel it moves a little fast.
Yeah.
I don't feel like it's entirely earned.
Oh, you mean movie-wise? Like
movie-wise.
Yeah,
okay. I feel like I could have used another couple of moments of great connection.
That's fair.
To get the relationship to this point. However, I think, you know, sometimes it's kind of like, well, what does the movie want me to think? I think the only way to interpret that in terms of the movie is that this is true love and that they just really connect. She knows very, very early on that she has this connection to this guy, and that's what it is. That's what I think. What do you think?
Fair point. I think it's driven from the 1980s thing. You know, the great 1980s films, you had the evolution of the relationship and it got to the point and you have, but in some other 80s films like this one, the relationships move fast. A nuclear war was going to happen at any moment. So we had to like kind of move fast in our relationships. And so that kind of is where I'm at, is that I think she feels the spark of new love. And she wants to consume it. Like she said, I just want to eat you up. Grandma's pinching baby cheeks. She's all about consuming him, right? And I don't mean that in a negative way. I mean that she's excited by this. And so she, as a scientist, half of her mind scientist, she wants to explore this more and be knee deep in it. And so I think that's the situation there. And so I don't see it as a negative thing, you know?
So, and I'll say here's a basic screenwriting rule or movie making rule, which is that if you have a man and a woman, let's say, and they are attractive and they are in a room together in a scene, the assumption is they're attracted to each other.
Right.
That is always true in films. Does that mean that is where the greatest romantic relationships in movie history come from? No. The best ones, you have to do more than that. But yeah. If you put two characters, male and female, together, and they're running from the police, or they're stuck in a basement, or they're, you know, starting a business together,
yeah.
The assumption is there is attraction there.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And while he figures out, hey, we can have a celebration right here. I'm going to order Chinese food, the most celebratory thing anyone can do.
Hey.
And listen, who doesn't love Chinese food?
Come on.
While he's doing that, she notices this big envelope sitting on the piano. She opens it up, and there is the layout for a cover article. Particle Magazine. Seth Brundle, youthful father of a new age. By the way, their idea for Particle Magazine was that this was People Magazine for physicists. Like the sexiest, coolest people, physicists in the world, were on the cover of Particle Magazine.
Richard Feynman, is that his name? He might have been on the cover of the first one. He might have been on the debut episode.
He was in the centerfold, actually.
Yeah, probably the centerfold.
The problem was until you opened the magazine, you couldn't tell whether he was alive or dead.
Oh.
Quantum physics joke right there. Schrodinger. Let's do it.
Nerd alert.
So she's obviously immediately upset because she feels betrayed.
Yes.
What?
Nothing. It's just personal bullshit.
I thought old married couples shared all their personal bullshit. That's how they stayed old and married.
Listen, Seth, don't rush it.
What are you talking about?
Look, I have to go out for a few hours.
She's the one that says don't rush it. Oh, yeah. My God. Hilarious.
I think if she hadn't said that sentence,
yeah,
I think none of this might have happened.
Great point.
If she actually had explained what was going on or just said something, but saying don't rush it right when he made, she brought up the old married couple thing.
Yeah.
I still have the residue of another life, you know. I have to scrape it off my shoe and get rid of it once and for all.
It's weird because how much has she really told him about her other life and the residue of her other life? He doesn't know much, right? So that's why it makes me feel like this is a little bit of a rebound situation, because she's not surrendering all the information. She's caught up in this romance and she's not. And then when she wants to be like, stop it, stop moving so fast, she does it. And then when she wants to move fast, she moves fast. So it's an interesting situation. And we're not blaming her, obviously, for what happens. But like, clearly there are missteps in this quick romance.
Stathis. Everything that has to do with transportation will become obsolete. And I am right there in the middle of it. The only recorder of the event from the inside out.
Hey. Look, just keep me informed. All right? As a friend? As a professional confidant?
That's all?
I don't want you to disappear from my life.
And again, this feels so different watching it today for me. And Cronenberg talks about this in the commentary track and says, it is sympathetic with Stathis during that line. Mm-hmm. I don't want you to disappear from my life. He's like, see, he really cares about her, which I think is true in a certain level. But now that line just feels, particularly from your boss, like it's pretty messed up.
Yeah.
She agrees. She starts to go. And then he says,
what about sex? Yeah, I'm not saying love or affection, just stress relieving sex, you and me.
Right. And this is where we have to be clear that this was all male writers involved in the process of making this movie. Male director, you know, obviously two men who are the leads here of this, or two of the three leads are men in this movie. And then you have Gina Davis. And so it's 1986. And yes, there was elevated intelligent content coming out in 1986. And certainly I think Cronenberg is setting this guy up to be, now in retrospect, I think you can see him as the true monster in the movie. But hearing you say that he was actually sympathetic to Stathis in this moment makes me wonder if the people involved in this weren't quite as advanced about gender politics as they should have been, and how that maybe they sympathize with Stathis and the things that he's doing. And like, oh, well, you know, you just have to kind of keep browbeating a woman until she says yes. You know, she'll give in. She resists because she has to. That's part of the game. There is this mentality. Certainly, I was taught that mentality growing up a lot by a number of male figures in my life, that you just kind of, you wear a woman down if she says no. You keep asking. You do certain things. And then you realize later in life, especially through Me Too, like you wake up and go like, no, actually, that wasn't the great way to approach the situation. And it wasn't with everything, but certainly I certainly had that at times. Not that I'd show up to people's houses and take showers in their places, but it was more a matter of like, you were told you've got to like, kind of like, you know, angle and speak and try to persuade. And you realize later in life that that's not actually something that women like respond to overall. And it's not a good way to exist, but that's what you were taught. And so I wonder if the people involved in this in the mid-1980s film saw Stathis as more sympathetic than we do now and saw Ronnie as being a bit of a mean person than we do now. You know, it's an interesting question to have because I don't find anything sympathetic about what Stathis does up until the final moment of right. the movie, you know?
So I think, and this is, you know, we've struggled this literally now for 400 episodes to deal with these kinds of issues, is I think it's really important to point out that there's no question in my mind that the viewpoint of the filmmakers is that Stathis's behavior is not cool.
Yes.
Like they're right. not saying when he makes that scene in the store or when he takes a shower in her shower without permission,
yeah.
that we're supposed to go, haha, that's fine.
Right.
But this is pre-Anita Hill. You know,
right.
So this is like, we haven't had this national conversation. And so yeah. the distance between like where we put it in terms of a boss and making these sexual innuendos right. and pressure, like we're not as aware of that then. I don't think David Cronenberg would make this character in this way again. He would be handled
right.
well. And you know, most bosses know, hey, you really shouldn't do that. You're going to get sued. You know, exactly. these are problematic things.
Right.
We're back with Seth, who is alone, he's drinking. And as soon as I see him drinking and talking to the baboon yeah. about Stathis, her old boyfriend, I'm like, oh, shit.
It's really the baboon who's to blame because the baboon should have talked him out of this. He should have calmed him down. And
really should have.
Put him to bed. Should have put him to bed.
From the desk of Stathis Barnes. How about under the desk of Stathis Barnes?
Ew.
She's working for her old boyfriend. Now she runs out late at night to see him. Was this the Ronnie game?
By the way, Jeff Goldblum was strangely jealous of John Getz, and it sounds like
what?
It sounds like it was a little bit almost method-y, which is that he kind of was conscious because he was dating Gina Davis at the
right,
time.
Right, right.
And when they went off to have scenes together without him, he was a little bit not happy about it. What? And then he was kind of trying to keep him apart a little bit. And it's hard to tell whether or not that was Jeff Goldblum actually being jealous,
right,
or him playing this character that he was very into, you know, and supporting that character.
That's so weird. But I mean, they ended up breaking up eventually, and maybe he had that. He was a jealous guy with her, possibly. I haven't read too many things about their relationship, but that might have been a part of it, you know.
And then I love that he turns to the baboon and says, I didn't mean to kill your brother. And while this is happening and the baboon is listening to him, a fly is circling the baboon.
Yeah. Great plant, right?
Well, and this is, well, it's, I would say it goes beyond plant because you know the movie you came to see.
Right, exactly.
You know, as soon as the movie is called The Fly. You've seen the trailer. You know what's happening. The way they did this is a real fly that is on a fishing line attached to a fishing pole, and they're just dangling it around the baboon.
It's really great because just as we're starting to buy into this relationship and we're seeing her like really fight for him and him like being excited about this relationship, that cover, she looks at it, says, you know, don't rush things, runs out, and he's left alone. And so just when we're feeling like we've forgotten that we've come to see the movie The Fly, maybe for a few seconds,
yep.
we hear The Fly. And once we hear The Fly, we're like, oh no, we know what's coming.
You know what I realized? One of my other resistances to scary movies sometimes is like, A, I don't relish being frightened. That's not a thing I look forward to. But the other thing that's come up before is like, I like smart characters.
Yeah.
And scary movies almost always have to have characters doing something really dumb at a certain point. And I just, so this is one of those moments of like, oh, don't, you're so smart. Why are you doing this? This is really dumb. Because he goes,
hey, you're all right. I'm looking at you. I can tell you're okay. What are we waiting for? Let's do it.
And that music that's been so sweet and romantic up to this point gets real heavy.
Yeah.
And we go through the same thing. We see the initiate teleportation sequence. We see the countdown. We see the baboon plane. We hear the fly. We see him naked in the pod. The camera moves in to the porthole, and we see that fly inside the glass. I think the baboon spots the fly inside the glass. Seth, who looks pretty calm, gets hit by that lightning. And then we're over at the other pod, and the door opens, and the smoke is moving. And it's a great reveal of him sitting there naked. He steps out, the baboon jumps into his arms, and we've done it.
We've done it, Steve. He is now Brendelfly.
Now you tell me, am I different somehow? Is it life or is it Memorex?
Which, for those youngins out there, that's an old commercial.
It's an old, yeah, exactly. And by the way, this is the beginning of the change, right?
Yes.
He walks out like a Greek god, confidently. Yes, he looked the same physically when he went in, but the way he walks out, and then the way the baboon jumps, he's almost like a Tarzan. The way he walks out, the baboon jumps into his arms. It's by the side, so he's prominently featured from the front of the camera. And so there is this sense of like he's become a god. And you, from this point forward, this is a much more powerful Seth Brendel, and Goldblum plays him as a much more powerful character physically in the movie.
I think Jeff Goldblum's great with all this, by the way.
Yeah, 100%.
Now she's walking down that long hallway back to the loft, which, by the way, this hallway is on location in Toronto. Mm. Everything else, that loft set is all built on sound stages. And then there's this thing, and again, it's because you know what movie you're in, is every time she's going to see him from this point forward, I'm scared. I'm nervous. What is she going to find, you know?
Yeah.
Finds him asleep in the sofa bed.
I missed you last night.
It's still night. I came back. You had to celebrate without me. I'm sorry.
I went through last night.
And boy, that's a reaction.
Yeah.
You went through? Without testing the baboon?
I was drunk. I was a bit upset.
And now he sits up in a chair, and you're right, by the way, he looks like a god. Jeff Goldblum did some serious working out for this movie.
I'm sure.
And this is where we hear the backstory.
He's an old boyfriend. He was teaching at college. I was a science major. He got me started in journalism.
Again, this is a thing, you know, we talked about Raiders of the Lost Ark and the fact that, you know, Indiana Jones was a teacher and she was a student. And in 1981, when Raiders of the Lost Ark comes out, that was fine, you know. And looking at it now, it's like, oh, teachers really aren't supposed to mess around with students anymore, you know.
I mean, they kind of never really were supposed to be doing it.
But it happened all the time.
It happened all the time, supposedly. And it was in a trope in a lot of movies.
Oh, what about our deal? You went through and I wasn't there.
Don't worry, I taped it for you.
You did?
Because that's part of him committing to their relationship, you know?
And she's softly surprised by that, you know, which she feels a sense of affection there as well, that he thought of her. Even in the drunken, jealous moment, he thought of her. You know?
He pulls her down to his lap, and the lighting is so perfect here because her face looks warm and the skin tone colors are vibrant and his face looks gray and darker.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And it's just done with the lighting.
So good.
They're kissing and then her hands reach to his back and go to this place where there are a bunch of really coarse hairs sticking out of his back. At this point, by the way, in the commentary track, Cronenberg goes off on how unscientific the 1958 version was. He was just very bothered. He was like, the things about the size of the head and the gravity and the weight of the head. And then he was talking about the help me famous help me shot where you see sort of all the little images. He's like, that's not how an insect's eyes operate. They don't see all the same versions of every image should be different. And it was so funny because, and then he also goes off the original movie takes place in Montreal, but everyone who speaks French speaks it with a French accent, not a French Canadian accent. And their clothing is more because Cronenberg's Canadian, their clothing is more from France and not from Quebec. And so like, it was just the reason I bring it up, he was more passionate about these issues than he was about anything in his own film. This was like, he was really offended by this.
I made a better movie.
They lie sleeping next to each other, and the camera moves in, and we just hear a fly circling. And then the music hits just as he reaches up and catches the fly almost asleep. Opens his hand, the fly flies away, and he looks at his hand. And again, his face is lit very gray.
Yeah.
Because something has changed.
He shocks himself that he's able to do this. And he knows deep within himself, something is wrong. Something is changed. Something is different. And it's not good. And you can tell by the look on his face. This isn't joy that he has the speed to catch a fly. It surprises him and it shocks him in a way that he's not quite ready to handle himself, as he just told Ronnie.
Yeah.
She couldn't handle it.
And at this point, where Seth Brundle has clearly changed, yeah, something has occurred, as I think is a good time to end part one of our exploration of The Fly. As always, we'd love to hear your thoughts. You can visit us on our Facebook page. Just do a search for The Cinephiles. It's Cine_Files on Twitter, The Cinephiles Podcast on Instagram. And if you want to buy or stream The Fly along with every other movie we've ever reviewed, you can do so at cinephiles.net. And if you want to support the show, as we said at the beginning, that's patreon.com/thecinephiles or Apple Podcasts, where you can get ad-free versions of the show, as well as our Cinephiles shorts. You can reach me at SR Morris on Twitter, SR Morris 1 on Instagram. John, how would they reach you?
Yeah, you can always reach me at The Roca Says on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok, The Outlaw Nation on Twitch, my YouTube channel, youtube.com/John Roca Says, where we just crossed 35,000 subscribers and want to keep on marching towards 50. So come and hang out and enjoy the content there, if you don't mind. And my other podcasts, the top 10, no, that doesn't exist anymore, the Geek Buddies and the Hot Mic. There you go.
The top 10. Wow. I think that is it for this week. We will be back next time to conclude our exploration of The Fly right here on The Cinephiles.
Ohio football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown, and he throws an awesome block so his teammate can score instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you another chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scorer scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. Everyone knows the most exciting part of football is the score. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you have a chance to keep the fun going even after the first player crosses the goal line. Plus, you can enjoy second chance all season long. Place a first TD scorer wager today. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.